privileged listener. The idea of the exceptional patient is not taught in medical school. I came to it only after a long period of unhappiness and soul-searching in my profession. I didn't have a class on healing and love, how to talk with patients, or the reasons for becoming a doctor. I was not healed during my training, and yet I was expected to heal others. In the early 1970s, after more than a decade as a practicing surgeon, I was finding my job very painful. It wasn't a typical case of burnout. I could cope with the unending problems, the intensity of the work, and the constant life or death decisions. But I've been trained to think my whole job was doing things to people in a mechanical way to make them better, to save their lives. This is how a doctor's success is defined. Since people often don't get better, and since everyone eventually dies, I felt like a failure over and over again. Intuitively, I felt there must be some way I could help the hopeless cases by going beyond my role as a mechanic. Surgeons aren't perfect. We always do our best, but complications still occur. Although disheartening, they keep us grounded and prevent us from starting to think of ourselves as gods. The one case that most shook my faith in myself was an injury to a facial nerve in a young girl I operated on early in my career. Seeing her wake up with half her face paralyzed made me want to hide forever. To become a surgeon in order to help people and then to end up disfiguring someone was a shattering experience. Unfortunately, I hadn't yet learned that my typical physician's response to hide my pain when something went wrong helped no one. The stress followed me home. Days before a difficult operation, I'd live it over and over in my mind, praying that the successful result I visualized would come to pass. Afterward, even if all went well, I'd suddenly wake up in the middle of the night questioning my decisions. Now, after years of being educated by my patients, I'm able to make each decision, live by it, and put it behind me, knowing I'm doing my best. One of the worst hardships is having so little time to spend with one's family. I had to adjust to the idea that being home on a weekend was a bonus, not something I could count on. Moreover, I was suffering from two-way guilt. Snatching a few hours off felt like stealing time from my patients, while the 16-hour days felt like stealing time from my wife and children. I didn't know how to respond to the guilt or how to unify my life. Throughout this period, I was thinking seriously about finding another career. I considered becoming a teacher or a veterinarian because veterinarians can hug their patients. I couldn't decide what I wanted, but I realized that most of my choices had to do with people. Even in the painting I did as a hobby, my only interest was portraits. Then it finally dawned on me. Here I was seeing scores of patients every day, as well as their families, dozens of doctors and nurses, and still I was looking for people. All this time I'd been dealing in cases, charts, diseases, remedies, staff, prognoses, instead of people. I thought of my patients merely as machines I had to repair. I was still debating whether to give up half a lifetime's learning to enter another specialty. Then one of my cancer patients, a concert pianist named Mark, helped me realize that I could be happy without changing my profession. As his condition improved, all his friends told him he should go back to the stage, but he said he knew he didn't belong there anymore. He had found he was happier just playing the piano at home. He was still doing what he loved, but he had changed the context to suit his own needs. I realized I needed to do the same. I tried to step out from behind my desk and open the door to my heart as well as my office. Now I literally have my desk against the wall, so my patient and I are in position to face each other as equals. I want to see my patient with no obstacle between us instead of relating as expert to failure. I began encouraging my patients to call me by my first name. In the beginning, it was quite scary to be just Bernie, not Dr. Siegel. To meet others as a person, not a label. It meant I had to like myself and deserve respect for what I did rather than what I learned in school. It's a simple yet effective way to break down the barrier between doctor and patient. Moving my desk and working on a first-name basis were only symptoms of a larger change. I committed the physician's cardinal sin. I got involved with my patients. For the first time, I began to understand fully what it's like to live with cancer, knowing the fear that it may be spreading even while you talk to your doctor, do the dishes, play with the kids, work, sleep, or make love. How hard it is to keep one's integrity as a human being with this knowledge. I no longer shielded myself emotionally from the scenes of sadness I had to witness each day. First, I began hugging patients, figuring they needed my reassurance. Later, I found I was saying, I need to hug you so that I could go on. And even if they were on respirators, my patients reached out to help me with a touch or a kiss, and my guilt, fatigue, and despair evaporated. They were saving me. In the face of such courage, time and again, I wished I could do something to ease the passage. I began to feel that my profession's methods of attempting to prolong life and cure disease, among the noblest goals of our civilization, were sometimes crueler than the way of the wild, where serious illness is quickly relieved by death. The elderly often wonder why they have lived so long, only to suffer such protracted misery and humiliation. I feel we should be able to do more to help a person let go and end life easily when the value of each day is gone. I am talking about natural means of letting go, which are available to us all when death is not considered a failure. The need for compassion to balance our medical heroism never struck me more forcibly than during the death of Stephen, one of my partner's friends. After a massive heart attack, he was strapped to a bed with tubes in every orifice. The damage was so great that a no-resuscitation order was issued. He was weeping in pain and fear, but no one would authorize any painkillers, afraid that the drugs would hasten the inevitable and look like euthanasia. Finally, my partner himself had to intercede, even though his friend was someone else's patient. He administered a shot of Nembutal. With the drugs, Stephen was able to relax and leave his body peacefully. He breathed a thank you and slipped quietly away in 5 minutes. How can we say we're prolonging life when a person has become no more than a valve between the intravenous fluids going in and the urine coming out? All we're prolonging is dying. The word hospital comes from the Latin for guest, but seldom is the institution truly hospitable. Little attention is given to caring or healing as opposed to medicating. I've often wondered why designers couldn't at least make the ceilings pretty, since patients have to spend so much time staring at them. There's a TV in every room, but what music, what creative, meditative, or humorous video is available to help establish a healing environment? What freedom is given patients to maintain their identity? While someone is in the hospital, the staff members become part of that person's family, for they see a patient more often and more intimately than anyone else. We must face that responsibility by offering the kind of loving support that we expect the family to provide. They can't do the whole job in a few hours of visiting time. A guide appears. In June 1978, my practice of medicine changed as a result of an unexpected experience I had at a teaching seminar. Oncologist O. Carl Simonton and psychologist Stephanie Matthews gave a workshop, Psychological Factors, Stress, and Cancer. When I looked around during the first workshop session, I was amazed and angered to find that I was the only body doctor there out of 75 participants. Those attending were mostly social workers, patients, and psychologists. I became even angrier when many of the participants told me they already knew about these techniques because the things I was learning hadn't even been hinted at in my medical education. Here I was, an MD, a medical deity, and I didn't know what went on in the head at all. I thought about the health records of doctors. They have more problems with drugs and alcohol and a higher suicide rate than their patients. They feel more hopeless than their patients and die faster after the age of 65. No wonder many people are reluctant to go to mainstream physicians. Would you take your car to a mechanic who couldn't get his own car to run? The Simontons taught us how to meditate. I sat down, closed my eyes, and followed directions. I didn't believe it would work, but if it did, I expected to see Jesus or Moses. Who else would dare appear inside a surgeon's head? Instead, I met George, a bearded, long-haired young man wearing an immaculate, flowing white gown and a skullcap. As the Simontons taught us to communicate with whomever we'd called up from our unconscious minds, I found that talking to George was like playing chess with myself, but without knowing what my alter ego's next move would be. George was spontaneous, aware of my feelings, and an excellent advisor. He told me I could do more good by remaining a surgeon, but changing myself to help my patients mobilize their mental powers against disease. I could combine the support and guidance of a minister or psychiatrist with the resources and expertise of a physician. I could practice clergy, a term my wife coined. In the hospital, I could be a role model for students, house officers, and even other physicians. George said, "You can go anywhere in the hospital. A clergyman or therapist can't. you are free to supplement medical treatment with love or death and dying counseling. I suppose you may call George a meditatively released insight from my unconscious. All I know is that he has been my invaluable companion ever since his first appearance. My life is much easier now because he does the hard work. George also helped me to see that as far as healing is concerned, exceptions do not prove the rule. If a miracle, such as permanent remission of cancer, happens once, it is valid and must not be dismissed as a fluke. If one patient can do it, there's no reason others can't. I realize that medicine has been studying its failures when it should have been learning from its successes. We should be paying more attention to the exceptional patients, those who get well unexpectedly, instead of staring bleakly at all those who die in the usual pattern. A group for rule breakers. After my experience with the Simontons, with the help of my wife Bobby and Marcia Eager, then a nurse in my office, I started a therapy group called Exceptional Cancer Patients, or ECAP, to help people mobilize their full resources against their disease. We had sent out 100 letters to patients. The letter suggested we could help them live better and longer through the techniques ECAP would teach them. We expected hundreds of replies. I began to get nervous about how to handle the crowd that would appear. 12 people showed up. That was when I started to learn firsthand what patients are really like. I found there are 3 kinds. About 15 to 20% of all patients unconsciously or even consciously wish to die. On some level, they welcome cancer or another serious illness as a way to escape their problems through death or disease. These are the patients who show no signs of stress when they find out the diagnosis. As a doctor is struggling to get them well, they are resisting and trying to die. If you ask them how they are, they say fine. And what's troubling them? Nothing. In the middle of the spectrum of patients is the majority, about 60 to 70%. They're like actors auditioning for a part. They perform to satisfy the physician. They act the way they think the doctor wants them to act, hoping that then the doctor will do all the work and the medicine won't taste bad. They'll take their pills faithfully and show up for appointments. These are the people who, given a choice, would rather be operated on than actively work to get well. At the other extreme are the 15 to 20% who are exceptional. They're not auditioning. They're being themselves. They refuse to play the victim. I get many letters from groups called Aid to Cancer Victims or some such title. The first thing I tell them is to change the group's name, because victims, by definition, do not have the control they need to redirect their mode of living. Exceptional patients refuse to be victims. They educate themselves and become specialists in their own care. It takes courage to be exceptional. I remember one woman who, when told she had to go to the X-ray department, replied, "No, this test hasn't been explained to me." When the attendants told her, "You could die tonight if you don't have this test," she said, "Then I'll die tonight, but I'm not leaving my room." Immediately, someone appeared to explain what the test was all about. Physicians must realize that the patients they consider difficult or uncooperative are those who are most likely to get well. Psychologist Leonard D. Rogatis, in a study of 35 women with metastatic breast cancer, found that the long-term survivors had poor relationships with their physicians, as judged by the physicians. They asked a lot of questions and expressed their emotions freely. Likewise, National Cancer Institute psychologist Sandra Levy has shown that seriously ill breast cancer patients who expressed high levels of depression, anxiety, and hostility survived longer than those who showed little distress. Levy and other researchers have also found that aggressive, bad patients tend to have more killer T cells, white cells that seek and destroy cancer cells, than docile, good patients. A group of London researchers under Keith Pettingale recently reported a 10-year survival rate of 75% among cancer patients who reacted to the diagnosis with a fighting spirit, compared with a 22% survival rate among those who responded with stoic acceptance or feelings of hopelessness. To find out whether you have the outlook of an exceptional patient right now, ask yourself this question. Do you want to live to be 100? In ECAP, we have found that the capacity to be an exceptional patient is accurately predicted by an immediate visceral yes, with no ifs, ands, or buts. Most people say, "Well, yes, as long as you can guarantee I'll be healthy." However, the persons who become exceptional patients know that life comes with no such warranty. They willingly accept all the risks and challenges. They know that happiness is an inside job. When I ask for a show of hands on this question, the response is invariably the same, about 15 to 20% for an average audience. There are far fewer yes answers, only about 5%, in a room full of doctors. Medical students are not so hopeless. It is trained into us. It's a tragedy that so few doctors have the self-confidence necessary to motivate others to believe in the future and care for themselves. Healthcare providers are so used to seeing only illness and handicaps that they rarely have a positive attitude. When I go to a holistic health group or to a rustic area where self-reliant individuals live, almost all the hands go up. These are people who look to the future with confidence, knowing that respect and love are available at all ages. I feel that all doctors should be required as part of their training to attend healing services at which people with so-called incurable diseases appear. The physician should be told they are not allowed to prescribe medications nor consider operations for these people, but simply told to go out and help them. Then doctors would learn that they can help by touching, praying, or simply sharing on an emotional level. It would also help to organize annual parties for survivors of serious illness so that physicians could see and talk with their successes, the people they've helped make well. Teaching each other. Exceptional patients want to be educated and made doctors of their own cases. One of the most important roles they demand of their physicians is that of teacher. As I began my transformation, people began to tell me things I hadn't heard before. I learned what many doctors are like in their offices. They shout. They keep patients waiting for 2 hours but refuse them 5 minutes of discussion. One patient told of walking into a doctor's office and finding a sign on the desk that said, "Compromise means doing it my way." My advice is, if you see a sign like that, turn around and walk out. As I began trying to teach my patients in the first ECAP group, I was amazed by the results. People whose conditions had been stable or deteriorating for a long time suddenly began to get well before my eyes. At first, this made me very uncomfortable. I felt they were getting well for illegitimate reasons. Their progress had no obvious relation to drugs, radiation, or other traditional treatments. I felt like a charlatan or swindler and actually suggested disbanding the group. At that point, my patients had to explain to me what was going on. "We're getting better," they told me, "because you've given us hope and put us in control of our lives. You don't understand because you're a doctor. Sit and be patient." I did, and they became my teachers. Then and there, we adopted as our motto a sentence from the Simonton's book, "In the face of uncertainty, there is nothing wrong with hope." Some doctors have advised patients to stay away from me so as not to build up false hope. For most physicians, giving false hope simply means telling a patient that he or she doesn't have to behave like a statistic. Instead, I say each person could be the one who survives because all hope is real in a patient's mind. Refusal to hope is nothing more than a decision to die. I know there are many people alive today because I gave them hope and told them they didn't have to die. As I began to learn from exceptional patients, I was finally able to decide wholeheartedly to remain a surgeon, so as to have direct, long-term relationships with patients. But I broadened my role from that of a mere mechanic to include some of the functions of a preacher, teacher, and healer. I accepted patients as individuals with choices and options. We became a team. A year before I began ECAP, I had shaved my head. Many associates thought it was a message of empathy for those who lose their hair during chemotherapy. But it had nothing to do with that. I later realized that it was a symbol of the uncovering that I was trying to make, bearing my own emotions, spirituality, and love. In fact, one nurse reminded me that shaving the head is standard preparation for any operation on the brain. The reactions were often revealing. Many people began to talk to me in a different way as though I were handicapped. They shared their pain readily. Some physicians berated me for being different, all the more reason for keeping my new look. My motives for baring my head became clearer at a workshop with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. One of her techniques is to have participants make drawings illustrating aspects of their lives. I made a picture of a mountain with snow on top, drawn with white crayon on white paper. Below it was a pond with a fish out of water. The key was that something was being covered up, white on white, and the spiritual symbol, the fish, was out of place. I realized that what I meant to uncover was my love and spirituality, not my scalp. It is from this period that I date my true career in healing, for it's only then that I found the full meaning of the work. The meaning consists of teaching patients how to live, teaching not from a pedestal, but rather with the knowledge that we teach what we want to learn. I became, as Bobby phrased it, a privileged listener. I began to hear all sorts of things that my patients felt were too emotional or too weird to tell other doctors. A few years ago, for example, a woman named Mary came to see me after her consultation with one of my surgical associates. She asked, "Are you the one who does visualizing and all that stuff?" When I told her I was, she said, "Good. I want to tell you something. Somebody's with me all the time. He wears a white robe and a purple sash, and he has bad teeth, and he's always in the room." I asked her, what's his name? What does he have to say? She said, "I don't have the nerve to talk to him." Mary is afraid to tell her family or her own doctor about her companion for fear they'd think she was crazy. But once she thought I was a little weird, too, it was safe to tell me. Such openness is an enormous advantage for physicians. How can we hope to help people who can't tell us everything that's troubling them? What a relief to this woman to find out that her guest might be just a spontaneous version of my own guide, George. Soon after we founded ECAP, some members of the group began to tell me that other physicians thought the things I was doing were crazy. By then, however, I was too happy about the members' improvement to care. I told them, as long as you do well, I don't have to worry about my reputation. Often, I can suggest exactly what patients' emotional troubles are based on the symptoms and location of their disease. After emergency surgery to remove several feet of dead intestine, a Jungian therapist recently told me, "I'm glad you're my surgeon. I've been undergoing teaching analysis. I couldn't handle all the shit that was coming up or digest the crap in my life." Any connection with her feelings might not have occurred to another physician, but it was no coincidence to us that the intestines were the focal point of her illness. Recently, after a mastectomy, a woman said to me that she needed to get something off her chest. I was tremendously excited after my first experiences with ECAP. I tried presenting my experiences at medical meetings. Almost no one was willing to admit, "Well, maybe there's something there, I'll try it." As a result, even though there is now plenty of scientific data to argue for psychotherapy and treatment of cancer and other diseases, I became convinced that statistics rarely alter deeply held beliefs. Numbers can be manipulated to make bias seem like logic. Rather than dwell on statistics, I now concentrate on individual experiences. To change the mind, one must often speak to the heart and listen. Beliefs are a matter of faith, not logic. Healing Partnership. One of the best ways to make something happen is to predict it. Pooh-poohed for some 20 years by the medical establishment, the placebo effect, the fact that about one-fourth to one-third of patients will show improvement if they merely believe they are taking an effective medicine, even if the pill they are taking has no active ingredient, has now been accepted as genuine by most of the profession. I am not urging that Western technological medicine be abandoned for earlier kinds, but I am asking that we become open to the healing gift within us. Science teaches that we must see in order to believe, but we must also believe in order to see. We must be receptive to possibilities that science has not yet grasped, or we will miss them. It's absurd not to use treatments that work just because we don't yet understand them. The placebo effect depends on a patient's trust in the physician. I've become convinced that this relationship is more important in the long run than any medicine or procedure. To create a relationship of trust, the doctor and patient must learn each other's beliefs. The belief systems of physicians and patients interact, but patients' bodies respond directly to their own beliefs, not their doctors. Physicians tend to be more logical, statistical, and rigid, and less inclined to have hope in their patients. When physicians run out of remedies, they're likely to give up. They must realize, however, that lack of faith in the patient's ability to heal can severely limit that ability. We should never say, "There's nothing more I can do for you." There's always something more we can do, even if it's only to sit down, talk, and help the patient hope and pray. The usual attitude of doctors is summed up perfectly in the experience of Stephanie, one of our ECAP patients. After the diagnosis of cancer, her doctor outlined the rest of her life as predicted by statistics, right into an early grave. She asked what she could do, and he told her, "All you've got is a hope and a prayer." She asked, "How do I hope and pray?" He replied, "I don't know. It's not my line." Her ECAP experience taught her how to hope and pray, and Stephanie has altered the course of her disease, exceeding expectations, and her doctor is now making notes about her success. Later, she wrote that this doctor, in mentioning hope and prayer, was actually prescribing the one medication that was going to cure me, and he never even knew it. The reverse effect can even kill. Frances, a woman in her 80s, came to me when she lost faith in her former physician because of his negative attitude. Despondent because of repeated nagging illnesses, she reached out to him for reassurance, and he asked her, "Well, how long do you want to live anyway?" She was smart enough to see what this outlook was doing to her, and she left. I remember one man who wasn't so lucky. Ellen, an ECAP group member, once called her husband Ray, who was hospitalized with cancer, to see how he felt. He said, "Fine." 15 minutes later, she arrived for a visit, and he was dead. In the interim, Ray, who'd been in and out of the hospital several times, had asked his doctor when he'd be able to leave. After the reply, "Oh, I don't think you'll make it this time," he died within minutes. The physician's habitual prognosis of how much time a patient has left is a terrible mistake. Physicians must stop letting statistics determine their beliefs. Statistics are important when one is choosing the best therapy for a certain illness, but once that choice is made, they no longer apply to the individual. All patients must be accorded the conviction that they can get well, no matter what the odds. Exceptional patients have the ability to throw statistics aside to say, "I can be a survivor," even when the doctor isn't wise enough to do so. Just think of the courage it took for someone to conquer a certain type of cancer that no one had ever conquered before. Hope instilled that kind of courage in William Calderon, who achieved the first documented recovery from acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS. Calderon was diagnosed in December 1982. His doctors told him he would probably be dead in 6 months. Understandably, he became depressed and hopeless. Almost immediately, Kaposi sarcoma, the type of cancer that most often accompanies AIDS, appeared and began spreading rapidly on all areas of his skin and throughout his gastrointestinal tract. Soon, Judith Scutch, co-founder with astronaut Edgar Mitchell of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and now president of the Foundation for Inner Peace, arrived at Calderon's hairstyling salon for her regular appointment. Noticing by his eyes that he had been weeping, she got him to tell her the reason. Her next words turned out to be the key to saving his life. She said, "William, you don't have to die. You can get well." Scutch described the Simonton's work with cancer patients. With unwavering love and support from her and from his lover, Calderon came to believe in his own survival. By continuing at the job he loved, he refused to give in to the disease. Instead, he began meditating and using mental imagery to combat it. He worked to restore strained relationships with his family and achieved peace of mind by forgiving people he felt had hurt him. He loved his body with exercise, good nutrition, and vitamin supplements. And from that point on, his immune system showed increased response and his tumors began to shrink. 2 years after the diagnosis, Calderon showed no signs of AIDS. It takes enormous strength to make the kind of spiritual and psychological changes that people who experience self-induced healings always make when the voice of authority is telling you you're supposed to die. I often get letters from doctors about patients I've referred. When a doctor reports amazing improvements in a patient's condition, he or she almost never mentions that person's beliefs and lifestyle. But when I inquire, I find the patient always has made some drastic change toward a more loving and accepting outlook. The patient seldom tells an unreceptive doctor about this, however. As long as my patients are living in a way that has value to them, I'm there to help them continue. However, if a patient has decided it's time to die, I see no contradiction in aiding with that too. I can help resolve conflicts that drain energy, knowing that this resolution may initiate healing after all. Twenty years ago, benign deception was common. Since then, attitudes have undergone a complete about-face. Fortunately, clinicians have realized that patients usually know the truth anyway. On an unconscious and even on a conscious level, Patients know what is going on in their bodies. Too many doctors today have gone from benign deception to a brutal honesty that also does more harm than good. I recently received a heartrending letter from a patient's wife explaining that her husband would not be keeping his second appointment with me because he had committed suicide. It was 2 days after he was told, with the most careless brutality, that he would never play tennis, captain a boat, or go to work again. All things he loved. All along, he had the most innocent faith in his doctors. Not that they could effect a cure, but that they were doing their best. They had no best. Far better to admit that the situation is grave, yet to remind the patient in truth that there is no incurable disease from which someone has not recovered, even at the threshold of death. When a doctor can instill some measure of hope, the healing process sometimes starts even before treatment begins. Dr. Alexandra Levine, a California oncologist, recently received a grant to study psychosocial aspects of cancer. She applied for it because of a similar experience. A man with extensive lymphoma was brought to her office. The patient's wife insisted he visit her before traveling all the way to Germany for a miracle cure he wanted to try. When Dr. Levine saw the panic in the man's eyes, she spent an hour simply calming and reassuring him. When he came back the next week, his tumors had shrunk by about half. She said, "I wish I had started your treatment last week." He told her, "You did." A sense of humor is an enormous asset, too. Many times when I'm in a room with a dying patient, we are laughing. Out in the hallway, the other staff members often think we are denying reality. We're simply still alive and thus able to laugh. Hospital personnel must realize that people aren't living or dying. They are either alive or dead. As long as they are alive, we must treat them that way. I find the word terminal terribly upsetting. It means we've begun to treat that person as though he or she were already dead. Studies have shown that it takes doctors and nurses longer to respond to the call button from a terminal patient's room than a button pressed by someone who is not labeled that way. The word implies a state of mind more than a physical condition, and it turns off the staff's empathy and ability to give the full measure of care needed. It also confronts them with their own mortality. It's also essential that patients know they can express anger to their physician without hurting the relationship. I've often heard people complain about their doctors, only to be asked not to mention it to them for fear of retribution in the future. Unexpressed anger hurts the patient and must be shared to establish a healing team. How poor the bond must be for a patient to believe that a doctor would not respond to criticism on a professional level. I'm happy when patients express anger at me because it means they feel safe with me, that we have a good relationship, and they are behaving like survivors. Unconscious awareness. Because of its effect on the patient, a doctor's attitude is often crucial to the success of treatment. One of the most important factors is a patient's confidence in having the doctor's undivided attention. I remember being in an operating room as an intern years ago with a patient under spinal anesthesia. Hearing only sports talk among the staff, he asked plaintively, "Won't someone please say something about me and my operation?" Picture the absurdity of a person with severe cancer having to listen to a technician worry about missing a hockey game or a doctor complain about being late to have her hair done. Only empathy can build the connection needed for healing. When a doctor sits down for 1 minute at the bedside to talk, the patient experiences it as 5 or 10 minutes. If the doctor stands in the doorway, the same visit seems like 15 seconds. Attitude counts even when the patient is unconscious, asleep, in coma, or under anesthesia. Milton Erickson, the great psychiatrist and hypnotherapist, showed in the early 1950s that voices known and meaningful to the patient were heard and understood during anesthesia. A Baltimore obstetrician once told me he had noticed a subtle change in his patient's behavior many years ago when the switch was made from ether to lighter anesthetics. To investigate, he brought a court stenographer into the operating room to record every word spoken during several cesarean sections. He found that under hypnosis, these patients could repeat the conversations word for word. For years, I've been utilizing the ability of unconscious patients to hear. I talk to persons in coma to let them know their medical status. In one case, I told a woman who had been in coma for 3 years with no signs of recovery that her family was giving her permission to go and that by dying she would not be a failure as a mother. I said they would miss her, but it was all right to let go if she wanted to. In 15 minutes she died. When I enter a room where a patient is sleeping, I simply announce myself softly and let his unconscious awareness awaken him if he wants to talk to me at that moment. If he doesn't wake up and there's no urgent problem, I return later. Several surgeons have now begun using the anesthetized mind's powers to help prevent complications. After lower back surgery, many people have trouble urinating and often need catheters because of spasms in the pelvic muscles. One group of researchers suggested to patients on the operating table that they would be able to relax the crucial muscles afterwards. None of these patients needed catheters. In the operating room, I'm constantly communicating with patients about what is happening, and I found that this can make the difference between life and death. Talking reassuringly to patients who are having cardiac irregularities during surgery can reverse the irregularities or slow a rapid pulse. Recently, I was operating on a very husky young man built like a football player. His size led to some minor technical problems, and while solving them, I looked up at the monitor and saw that his pulse was 130. I knew that he had been anxious about the operation, so I said to him, "Victor, I'm having some mechanical difficulties because you're a big guy, but there's no problem with the surgery. This part is just a little difficult to do. You're doing well. Don't be nervous. I'd like your pulse to be 83. During the next few minutes, without any other medication, his pulse came right down to 83 and remained there. Many anesthesiologists who've heard of such episodes have begun speaking to their anesthetized patients, giving them calming messages. Fear-filled messages can increase the incidence of cardiac arrest. Once, as I finished a difficult emergency abdominal operation on a young, very obese man, his heart stopped. He didn't respond to resuscitation. The anesthesiologist had given up and was walking out the door when I spoke out loud into the room, "Harry, it's not your time yet. Come on back." At once, the cardiogram began to show electrical activity, and the man ultimately recovered fully. I can't prove it, of course, but I am sure the verbal message made the difference. I know the experience made believers out of the other staff members who were present, and there is certainly no reason not to communicate with a patient in every possible way. It's especially important to avoid negative messages, because the anesthetized patient's conscious defense mechanisms aren't functioning. I always make sure that operating room personnel don't say anything they wouldn't say if the patient were awake. When a surgeon makes a quip like, "If he ever leaves here, it'll be feet first," it's no wonder the patient wakes up crying in the recovery room. One can be honest about the diagnosis and still implant positive thoughts about the future treatment. A simple statement like, "You'll wake up comfortable, thirsty, and hungry," modified for obese patients, will promote recovery. Even the desire to smoke can be reduced by a suggestion at the end of the operation. I also do not hesitate to ask the patient not to bleed if circumstances call for it. It's well known that yogis and hypnotized subjects can control bleeding, and the verbal request also seems to work during anesthesia. The ambience of the clinical environment influences the attitude of both doctor and patient. I fear that we lost one of our most important sources of strength, a connection to God and nature, when hospital planners took the windows out. A view of the outside world reminds us of our link to all life, helping us survive. Recent research at a hospital in Pennsylvania showed that patients whose rooms faced an open courtyard, a tree, and the sky got well faster than those whose rooms faced a brick wall. The healing properties of music have been known since biblical times. Music opens a spiritual window. When I first brought a tape recorder into the OR, it was considered an explosion hazard. But we ran it on batteries, and then the nurses and anesthesiologists felt so much better that if I forgot my music, they'd ask for it. I encourage patients to use tapes of whatever music they find most relaxing or healing in order to adapt the hospital environment to a healing environment. One patient listening to harp music just before the operation began said, "It's a good thing I heard that while I'm awake. If I woke up and heard it, I wouldn't know where I was." Another day, a patient under local anesthesia started laughing and said, "Most appropriate," while I was removing a large benign tumor. In the background, Frank Sinatra was singing, "Why Not Take All of Me?" The mechanic and the healer. The value of identifying with the patient explains why the best doctors are often those who've been seriously ill themselves. Throughout our training, we learn not to empathize with the sick, supposedly to save us psychic strain. All our terminology emphasizes the separation. Instead of a heart attack, the hospital page operator says, "Code 5. The emotional distance hurts both parties, however. We withdraw just when the patient needs us most. Nurses know how hard it is to find the doctor when a patient is dying. All our education encourages us to think of ourselves as gods of repair, miracle workers. When we can't fix what's broken, we crawl off to lick our wounds, feeling like failures. The distance also encourages doctors to feel invulnerable. It's always other people who are sick, not me. When I tell a room full of medical students almost everybody dies, they all laugh. For when I say the same line to a room full of doctors, there's dead silence. We become the best deniers of all." A severe staph infection, which once kept me in a hospital for a week, was a crucial part of my education. I found out the difficulties of being in isolation, hooked up to an intravenous line, required to call for help for everything I needed when I was used to being responsible and in control. I found how hard it is to maintain your dignity in the skimpy gowns that the hospital provides. This illness came at a time of many changes in my life. A new home, more children, starting practice, all positive events, and yet I became ill. It made me aware that patients in my office must be experiencing similar things. I began to joke with them about changes in their lives. I would ask, "Did you get a new job? Did you move to a new house?" They were astonished. How did I know? I learned more about what doctors were like, too, since I was a physician. I had eminent professors caring for me, but I couldn't get them all together at one time to give me a straight answer. They even wanted to move me to a more depressing, windowless ward because it was closer to one professor's office. I said no and told them I was leaving the hospital. Suddenly, everyone showed up. I think a few days as a patient on a busy ward should be an integral part of every physician's training, including, as one patient recently added, an IV in his arm and a tube up his nose. Most tribal cultures recognize a similar necessity. Usually one cannot become a healer without first passing through sickness to health. The denial of empathy benefits no one. As mechanics, we doctors always fail in the long run. But as counselors, teachers, healers, and caregivers, we can always contribute and even help at the moment of death. Then there's no need to hide in the cafeteria with the beeper and force the nurse to face the patient's death alone. A cooperative arrangement in which the doctor and patient both realize that they are essentially the same, except for a few years' training, offers more to both than the accustomed roles of master and supplicant. This expanded outlook helps the doctor to inspire hope, give with the heart, as well as with the head and hands, keep ego in the background, and share major decisions with the patient. The love returns in words and looks of gratitude, in cards and letters, and in little gifts for the office, all of which restore you. A doctor who acts out of love doesn't burn out. He or she may get tired physically, but not emotionally. The wonders produced by close doctor-patient collaboration never cease to amaze me. Thelma, a patient with recurrent breast cancer, came to me and said that she wanted God to heal her while I observed and monitored the process. I explained how difficult I thought that would be. On her next visit, the cancer was smaller, and I asked her what had happened. She said, "I left the house with the phone ringing." It was the first time she'd ever said no to anything. Next time, her cancer was even smaller. Again, I asked what had happened. All smiles, she said, "When my alcoholic husband acted up, I called the police. He said, 'You're embarrassing me in front of the neighbors.' I told him, 'I have cancer now, and I don't accept your behavior anymore.'" By the third visit, however, she realized how much I cared for her, and we became a team. She said, It's hard work becoming a saint and healing yourself. Why don't you operate and remove the tumor? I'll work on staying well. Thelma told me that the night after surgery, the nurse came in, pulled the curtain and said, "Tell me about Dr. Siegel." My patient responded, "What do you mean? You act like you think he hypnotized me." The nurse said, "Well, you've had a radical mastectomy, and yet you're walking around the ward cheering up the rest of us, and you have no pain. What did he do to you?" He shared with me, "This was our decision, so there's no reason for me to be depressed or in pain. I know the right thing was done for me by the right person. This is my way of getting well." We physicians must become instruments. When that happens, motivated patients will use us to work miracles. Disease and the mind. The mind, benign or malign. Part of the mind's effect on health is direct and conscious. The extent to which we love ourselves determines whether we eat right, get enough sleep, smoke, wear seatbelts, exercise, and so on. Each of these choices is a statement of how much we care about living. These decisions control about 90% of the factors that determine our state of health. The trouble is that most people's motivation to attend to these basics is deflected by attitudes hidden from everyday awareness. As a result, many of us have mixed intentions. Consider, for example, Sarah, a woman who came to me with breast cancer a few years ago. She was smoking when I walked into her hospital room. Her action clearly stated, "I want you to get rid of my cancer, but I'm ambivalent about living, so I think I'll risk a second cancer." She looked up sheepishly and said, "I suppose you're going to tell me to stop smoking." "No," I said, "I'm going to tell you to love yourself. Then you'll stop." She thought for a moment and replied, "Well, I do love myself. I just don't adore myself." Sarah ultimately did come to adore herself and stopped smoking. It was a good quip, but it exemplified an important problem many people have with themselves. Self-love has come to mean only vanity and narcissism. The pride of being and the determination to care for our own needs have gone out of the meaning. Nevertheless, an unreserved, positive self-adoration remains the essence of health, the most important asset a patient must gain to become exceptional. Self-esteem and self-love are not sinful. They make living a joy instead of a chore. The mind does not act only through our conscious choices, however. Many of its effects are achieved directly on the body's tissues without any awareness on our part. Consider some of our common expressions. "He's a pain in the neck." "He's a pain in the ass." "Get off my back." "The problem is eating me up alive." "You're breaking my heart." The body responds to the mind's messages, whether conscious or unconscious. We don't yet understand all the ways in which brain chemicals are related to emotions and thoughts. But the salient point is that our state of mind has an immediate and direct effect on our state of body. We can change the body by dealing with how we feel. If we ignore our despair, the body receives a die message. If we deal with our pain and seek help, then the message is living is difficult but desirable, and the immune system works to keep us alive. I therefore use two major tools to change the body: emotions and imagery. These are the two ways we can get our minds and bodies to communicate with each other. Coping with stress. It is often said that stress is one of the most destructive elements in people's daily lives, but that's only a half-truth. The way we react to stress appears to be more important than the stress itself. The onset and course of disease are strongly linked to a person's ability and willingness to cope with stress. Stresses that we choose evoke a response totally different from those we'd like to avoid but cannot. Helplessness is worse than the stress itself. This is probably why the rate of cancer is higher for blacks in America than for whites, and why cancer is associated with grief and depression. The level of stress is determined partly by society. Cultures that place the highest value on a combination of individualism and competition are the most stressful. Those that seem to produce the least stress and have the lowest rates of cancer are close-knit communities in which supportive, loving relationships are the norm, and the elderly retain an active role. Religious faith and a fairly open, accepting attitude towards sexuality are two common characteristics of low-cancer societies. Stress can be measured. One of the yardsticks for it, developed by Drs. Thomas Holmes and Richard Raw, uses a list of 43 stressful changes to assess a person's likelihood of becoming ill. The evaluation begins with the history of the person's recent emotional life, then assigns a certain number of points to each life crisis, such as changing or losing a job, children leaving for college, marriage or divorce, moving to a new house, and so on. The highest value, 100 points, is attached to the most grievous loss, the death of one's spouse. This most traumatic of events is often followed by cancer or other catastrophic illness in 1 or 2 years. Recent studies have confirmed that grieving spouses have depressed immune systems for over a year. New evidence suggests that divorce may be even more devastating to many people, since it's harder to accept that the relationship is really over. Indeed, divorced people have higher rates of cancer, heart disease, pneumonia, high blood pressure, and accidental death than married, single, or widowed persons. Married men also have 1/3 the lung cancer incidence of single men and can smoke 3 times as much with the same cancer incidence as single men. In dealing with the problems presented by cancer, therefore, we must not forget the effects this crisis may have on family and friends, particularly if the patient dies. The doctor must help the others deal with their fears and grief openly in an effort to prevent further disease. When stress is confronted and love is shared, everyone, the family as well as the patient, benefits. Quiet desperation. Not everyone who suffers a tragic loss or stressful change in lifestyle develops an illness. The deciding factor seems to be how one copes with the problem. Those who can give vent to their feelings yet continue with their lives generally stay well. The husband of a patient once called me up and asked, "What did you tell my wife?" He said she came home and yelled at him for hours about their 20 years of marriage, and he thought they had been pretty good. I told him, "I didn't say anything to your wife, but she has learned that she has cancer, and she's sharing the resentment that she has built up over the years." If a person deals with anger or despair when they first appear, illness need not occur. When we don't deal with our emotional needs, we set ourselves up for physical illness. The simple truth is, happy people generally don't get sick. One's attitude towards oneself is the single most important factor in healing or staying well. Those who are at peace with themselves and with their immediate surroundings have far fewer serious illnesses than those who are not. One of the most common precursors of cancer is a traumatic loss or feeling of emptiness in one's life. When a salamander loses a limb, it grows a new one. In an analogous way, when a human being suffers an emotional loss that is not properly dealt with, the body often responds by developing a new growth. It appears that if we can react to loss with personal growth, we can prevent growth gone wrong within us. Typical depressed patients, by abdicating normal activity, are at least offering some response to what they perceive as an unbearable situation. The reaction is negative, but at least it's an attempt to back away. Many people, however, continue with their routines and an outward show of happiness, when on the inside their lives have come to lack all meaning. These persons are seldom diagnosed as clinically depressed because they manage to keep functioning. Their state is the quiet desperation of James Thurber's Walter Mitty, meek and obliging on the outside, but filled with unacknowledged rage and frustration. During more than 2 decades of research into the mental aspects of cancer, experimental psychologist Lawrence Lashon conducted personality studies of 455 cancer patients and in-depth therapy of 71 terminal cases. He found that this condition of despair, so named to distinguish it from the more commonly recognized form of depression, was reported as predating the disease by 68 of the 71 cancer patients in therapy, by only 3 of 88 other clients who did not have cancer. In The Will to Live, Arnold Hutchinecker wrote, "Depression is a partial surrender to death, and it seems that cancer is despair experienced at the cellular level." Working with breast cancer patients, Moens Jensen of the Yale Psychology Department showed that defensive repressors die faster than patients with a more realistic outlook. These are the smiling ones who don't acknowledge their desperation, who say, I'm fine, even though you know they have cancer, their spouses have run off, their children are drug addicts, and the house just burned down. Jensen feels this behavior dysregulates and exhausts the immune system because it is confused by the mixed messages. Thus, when a patient tells me he or she is fine, I have to know whether it's a performance or the truth. One must be careful when evaluating a patient who says cancer is not stressful. It may not be if it's a solution to life's problems. Then again, if one can face the disease with peace of mind instead of fear, it becomes a challenging stress rather than a purely destructive one. The outcomes will be different, and they will not be interpreted properly unless the attitudes are carefully measured by psychological testing. Jensen also noted that those with imagery or daydreams that were always positive, in the sense of denying illness or the possibility of death, had a poor chance of survival. Imaging techniques don't work with people who deny, because they can't accept their illness and therefore don't really participate in fighting it. Psychiatrist George Engel surveyed the evidence and concluded that the most important factor in bringing on despair is usually a change in the environment about which the patient feels powerless. In other words, he or she has a sense of hopelessness and helplessness. Sudden death often follows these changes. Both men and women are subject to hopelessness, but because of their divergent roles, the situations that trigger it are often different. Men typically get sick soon after losing a job or retiring, because they have traditionally identified more strongly with their work than women have. Men are generally better able to express anger, while women tend to hold it in and become depressed. For them, the change generally happens in the home. It may be a divorce or the growing up and departure of children. As a woman who developed cancer after her children left home expressed it in a letter to me, I had an empty place in me and cancer grew to fill it. The cause may simply be a gradual dissatisfaction with the role of housewife if that role is unfulfilling for the woman. It is not the role itself, but rather the feeling of being trapped. Housewives get 54% more cancer than the general population and 157% more than women who work outside the home. When these results were first published by Dr. William Morton of the University of Oregon, many researchers assumed there must be a carcinogen in the kitchen, and much fruitless research was spent looking for it. Now, there may well be some carcinogens in many American kitchens, but a further statistical analysis revealed that salaried domestics have less cancer than the housewives, despite working in two kitchens. However, most research funds still are allocated to look for chemical causes. Little thought has been given to the possibility that the housewife's high risk of cancer may be due to her feeling trapped and the fact that often she is not living the life she wants, but a performance. Lack of emotional outlet is a common theme in the histories of cancer patients. It is probably the reason cancer is more common in convents than in prisons. In jail, you can at least act out your frustrations. To some extent, then, cancer is not a primary disease. It is partly a reaction to a set of circumstances that weaken the body's defenses. That is why when a doctor cures cancer or some other disease without ensuring that the treatment addresses the patient's entire life, a new illness may appear. Since everyone is subject to external changes, truly effective treatment must get a patient to become the kind of person who can live comfortably and happily in spite of such stresses. This process is never complete, but it is the process itself that benefits our bodies. One does not have to be a saint to be healed. It is the effort of working towards sainthood that brings the rewards. Personality programming. As a young woman, my mother had severe hyperthyroidism and weighed about 90 pounds. She also desperately wanted a child. She went to many obstetricians, but they all said her body couldn't stand the strain and she would probably die if she became pregnant. After several years, during which her condition didn't improve, she and my father decided a baby was worth the risk. Finally, my parents found one obstetrician who was willing to help my mother take the chance. He told her he would support her in her attempt to carry through a normal pregnancy if she could gain 30 pounds. My mother gained her required weight and conceived, and I was born. The delivery was traumatic. At first, my features were grossly distorted from the forceps. My mother took me for walks in the carriage. She covered it to hide me. Neighbors would stop, lift the cover, and start to coo, oh, what a cute, until they caught a glimpse, saw that the usual phrases weren't appropriate, and were left gaping. my mother decided to keep me home and save the neighbors embarrassment. My grandmother stepped in, anointing and stroking my face until the damage healed, relieving my mother of her distress and continuing the unconditional love. These first experiences conditioned me to be a survivor. Life became a series of obstacles that I always felt I could overcome. If I was not valued by others, I knew I could count on my family and the self-esteem they helped me develop. In a sense, this was a handicap for me as a physician because I didn't realize what went on in other people's lives. The hardest lesson for me to learn was that most of my patients are not the products of such love. In fact, I would estimate that 80% of my patients were unwanted or treated indifferently as children. How dissimilar my experience from those who hear, "We always wanted a boy instead of a girl." Or, "Your father was a drunk, we didn't want more children." Or even, "I wish I'd had an abortion instead of you." Such messages lead to a lifelong feeling of unworthiness. Then an illness is something the patient deserves, and treatment becomes undeserved. For such people, the disease can be their way of finally satisfying their parents' wishes, or God's, since many people carry a burden of guilt from their religion, experiencing illness as punishment for sin. At bottom, they feel that the only way they can receive love is by dying. One of my patients was a New Yorker named Jan, who'd been an actress since her early teens. Her mother had constantly warned her to protect her breasts, since they were all important for her appearance. She told her she couldn't sleep on her stomach, and when she danced, she should be careful no one bumped them. Naturally, Jan got breast cancer. I told her that if she could concentrate her incredible energy on one or two choices and learn to love herself, she would have a chance for a cure. But like many performers, she lived mainly for the approval of others. She said, "If I don't hear any applause, how do I know I'm lovable?" She died of her disease, burning away her energy, looking for an outside miracle. The miracles come from within. You are not that unloved child anymore. You can be reborn, rejecting the old messages and their consequent diseases. When you choose to love, you will have those days when you're not all you'd like to be. But you can learn to forgive yourself. You can't change your shortcomings until you accept yourself despite them. I emphasize this because many people, especially those at high risk of cancer, are prone to forgive others and crucify themselves. I see all of us as being perfectly imperfect and ask that we accept ourselves that way. As Elizabeth Kubler-Ross says, "I'm not okay, you're not okay, but that's okay." To become exceptional in caring for the body, one must take stock of the beliefs one has about it, especially those so ingrained that they're normally unconscious. If a person can turn from predicting illness to anticipating recovery, the foundation for cure is laid. I have a patient, a frail woman named Edith, who weighs all of 85 pounds. She told me, "I don't need you and your group. My mother always told me when I was a youngster, 'You're scrawny, but whatever happens, you will always get over it. You'll live to be 93, and then they'll have to run you over with a steamroller.'" Edith has survived a heart attack, a bleeding ulcer, the death of her husband, and breast cancer invading the chest wall. She is now alive more than half a dozen years after her surgery. Every time something happens, she hears her mother's words. If we all programmed our children this way, we'd be creating survivors. Instead, negative conditioning is all too common. Over the years, I've found that my patients tend to get the same diseases as their parents and to die at the same age. I think conditioning is at least as much a factor as genetic predisposition. I call it psychological genetics because I've seen people change the scenario once they became aware of it. Too many people think they're doomed to reenact their parents' scripts. As a nurse told me after one of my lectures, "I think you may have saved my life. I've been waiting to die of cancer. Since my mother has it and my father had it, it never occurred to me that I didn't have to have it." Target organs. Target organs, parts of the body with special significance to the conflicts or losses in a person's life, are the most likely areas for disease to take root. Persons susceptible to cancer should develop many primary tumors at one time in various parts of the body. Instead, they invariably develop cancer in only one area that is psychologically significant to them, the target organ. I remember one woman in the hospital who gave me a positive statement when I asked her how she visualized her x-ray therapy. She said, I see it as a golden beam of sunshine entering my body. I told her, someone must have been here before me and explained all this to you. She said, just the woman in the next bed. A woman with both hands in bandages was lying there. I talked to her and learned that 6 or 7 years before, she'd had a mesothelioma, was told she'd be dead in 6 months, made enormous spiritual changes in her life, and the disease had disappeared. I asked, why did you need this illness? And she said, I don't know. We talked for a while, and she told me she had a lovely husband and 2 beautiful children. But at home, there was no one to talk to about the incredible changes she had made in healing herself. And it was wonderful to be in the hospital. She had all the interns, nurses, and staff to talk to. I said, aha, then that's why you're here with your hands wrapped up with these infections. And I said to her, I'll find people for you to talk to. You go ahead and get well. One of my breast cancer patients was a perfect example, not only of this connection, but also of the hope that comes from realizing the connection. Diana's son had lost his life in a hit-and-run accident, and she was making an enormous effort to track down the killer, since the police had botched the job and ruined the evidence. Her friends kept telling her that she was literally killing herself. She became overweight and developed high blood pressure. Finally came the breast cancer that compounded her despair. As we talked, however, Diana came to realize that her own emotions and actions had contributed to her disease, and that by changing them, she could contribute to her ability to get well. After she left the office, my nurse asked, didn't you tell her she has cancer? Of course, I replied, why? Because she was smiling on the way out. Many patients already know something of this link and only require an open-minded doctor to be able to use the knowledge. I was always considered spineless, and here I've developed multiple myeloma of my backbone. Or a woman involved in a stressful love affair with a married man says, I was afraid I'd get cancer, and I knew if I did, it would be in the cervix. After seeing a man with cancer of the rectum, I asked him what happened in the last year or two of his life. He said, nothing much. So I asked his daughter. She said she had married out of the family religion and her brother had run away from home. Later, while helping the man explore his attitudes in ECAP, one of the other members said, that boy must have been some pain in the ass. A multiple sclerosis patient whose household help left her with 5 young children to care for lost the use of her right hand. She had just lost her right-hand man. To an outsider, a connection may sometimes seem far-fetched, but only the patient can finally judge whether it's real or not. Having seen it happen time and time again, I've concluded that we sensitize the target organs of our bodies in a form of negative biofeedback. Psychological profile of cancer. Today, we are able to sketch a fairly complete psychological profile of those people who are most likely to develop cancer. The typical cancer patient, let's say a man, experienced a lack of closeness to his parents during childhood, a lack of the kind of unconditional love that could have assured him of his intrinsic value and ability to overcome challenges. As he grew up, he became strongly extroverted, but not so much from an innate attraction to others as from a dependency on them for validation of his own worth. Adolescence was an even harder time for this future cancer patient than for other teenagers. Difficulty in forming more than superficial friendships led to an excruciating loneliness and reinforcement of earlier feelings of inadequacy. Such a person tends to view himself as stupid, clumsy, weak, and inept at social games or sports, despite real achievements that are often the envy of classmates. At the same time, he may cherish a vision of the real me, who is supremely gifted. But this authentic self is carefully hidden in the belief that it would jeopardize the subjectively minimal acceptance and love that the person has received. He thinks, if I act the way I really feel, childlike, brilliant, loving, and crazy, I'll be rejected. I gave one of my patients, a young woman named Adrienne, a copy of Gerald Jampolsky's book, Love is Letting Go of Fear. After she'd read it, she told me, I was like this book. I was a flower child, in love with the world, and my parents said, grow up. So I grew up and got cancer. And you walk in and say, become a child. Adrienne went back to her authentic loving self and is well today. Loving doesn't mean one hasn't grown up. Being childlike is not childish. At some time, however, usually in the late teens or early 20s, the patient-to-be falls in love, finds one or two close friends, gets a job that provides real satisfaction, or otherwise reaches some level of happiness based outside the self. He is unable to take any credit for this turn of events. It seems like pure luck, more than he deserves. But for the time being, all is well. Sooner or later, it may be a few years, it may be decades, the external meaning vanishes. The friends move away. The job disappears or becomes less satisfying. The loved spouse leaves or dies. These changes happen to us all, and they are always painful. But to someone who has put all his eggs in one basket, the loss is disabling. Yet it usually doesn't appear to be. Others think he is taking it remarkably well, but inside there is a hollowness. All the old feelings of unworthiness come flooding back, and all feeling of meaning in his life is lost. The routine usually goes on. Having been a compulsive giver since childhood, the future cancer patient continues going through the motions with whoever remains in his life, until depleted and exhausted. Over and over again, I hear friends and relatives say, "He was a saint. Why him?" The truth is that compulsively proper and generous people predominate among cancer patients because they put the needs of others ahead of their own. Cancer might be called the disease of nice people. They are nice by other people's standards, however. They are conditional lovers. They are giving only in order to receive love. If their giving is not rewarded, they are more vulnerable to illness than ever. It's important for a patient to understand the lifelong pattern, but for the immediate purpose, getting well, the problem must be put in terms that can be dealt with now. In most cases, this involves a recognition of conflict. For cancer patients, it usually means finding out how the needs of others, seen as the only ones that count, are used to cover up one's own. Often a real power struggle develops. I saw this most clearly and tragically in the case of Norma, a NECAP member with an abusive husband. Her disease started to disappear as she became more self-caring. Then her husband developed heart disease and was hospitalized. Norma was faced with a choice. Rather than force her husband to choose between growing with her or fostering his illness, she chose to return to her old self. He resumed his abuse and got well, while she went home to die, telling the rest of the group there was to be no funny business, no attempts to change her mind if we came to visit her. Each of us has more or less the same choices. Norma's husband could have learned to love, or she could have asserted herself and gone on to live. But old patterns, though painful, are easier. Change is difficult, uncomfortable, and frightening. That's how we know we're changing. It is often extraordinarily hard for the compulsive giver to stop to say no without feeling guilty. Many of my female patients have come to group meetings saying, "I'll do anything to get well." Then I outline our program, including time for exercise and meditation, and they say, "Oh, but then dinner will be late." A patient named Sharon told us her husband's secretary had left, so she had to go in and work for him until he could find a replacement. The trouble was, she hated the job. I told her, "You can't survive cancer if you get up every morning thinking how you hate what you'll be doing all day." Still, it took her 2 or 3 months to, as she put it, give her husband notice. When individuals think about saying no, the thing that most often helps them do it is the sense of a time limit in their lives. If you knew you had a day to live, would you spend 3 hours lying in the x-ray department, waiting for a test to be done? Hell no. You'd say, "Take me back to my room. This is the last 24 hours of my life, and I'm not going to spend 1/8 of it in the x-ray department." I'd tell all my patients to make their choices based on what would feel right if they knew they were going to die in a day, a week, or a year. That's one way of giving people an immediate awareness of how they feel, even if they have never paid any attention to feelings. We don't have the luxury of 5 years of psychoanalysis when someone may not live that long. We have to begin change immediately, and the best way is by asking what you'd want to do with a short period of time. Individual reactions. The one crucial question is what approach will work for each person. Never underestimate the value of the truth, even if it's a shock. I remember a patient who was in congestive heart failure, not taking her medicine, smoking like a chimney, and then coming to me for a gallbladder operation. I asked her, "Did you come here to have me kill you?" The question surprised her, and she said, Nobody has talked to me like that since I gave up psychotherapy. I just explained that before I could deal with her gallbladder, I had to deal with her depression and try to give her a reason for living. I recently saw a patient with a brain tumor that had already progressed to the point of causing seizures. She was trying to decide whether to have it surgically removed or treated only with a nutritional program. A friend had asked her to talk to me since her regular doctors were all angry at her for shying away from aggressive treatment of this critical illness. I sat and talked with her until we got to the root of the problem, the fact that she was very depressed with no great desire to go on living. Therefore, it was easier for her to just change her diet a little. This would cause her no great discomfort, and if she died, it would be no great loss as far as she was concerned. My effort then was to show her how to make her life interesting enough to continue living. Then she would be in a position to choose modern techniques for dealing with the emergency, as well as to change her outlook thoroughly for the future. I recommend that patients do not reject standard medical techniques, at least as one option. Drugs and surgery buy time and may cure while patients work to change their lives. Soon after we'd set up ECAP, I was interviewed by the Midnight Globe tabloid. The resulting article was very fair and the quotations accurate, but I was upset by the headline, "Surgeon Says Mind Can Cure Cancer." I thought it was simplistic and misleading. The more I worked with patients, however, the more I came to see that the statement was correct. Now I consider those omnipresent supermarket newspapers to be important medical journals. I say this tongue mostly in cheek. The mind can cure cancer, but that doesn't mean it's easy. The paradox is wonderfully expressed by an old Sufi story. A stranger comes upon a man on his hands and knees under a street lamp in front of his house. He's looking for his keys, and the stranger gets down on all fours to help him. After a time, the stranger asks, "Where exactly did you drop them?" "In my house," comes the reply. Exasperated, the stranger asks, "Then why are you looking out here?" "Because it's dark in the house. The light is better in our conscious minds, but we must look for healing in the dark unconscious. The doctor works in the light. He is verbal and logical. The patient's world may be dark, but there are sources of illumination. Within each of us is a spark. Call it a divine spark, if you will, but it is there and can light the way to health. There are no incurable diseases, only incurable people." The will to live. For many people, "you have cancer" are the three most dreaded words in our language. Initially, the diagnosis is always handled with some degree of denial. This allows a person to accept it over a period of time. Sometimes patients are more depressed 6 months later than when they first hear the bad news, because it may take that long to truly hear what they have been told. Some persons seem to disbelieve the diagnosis, going on with their lives as though nothing is wrong. Usually, they are simply denying their emotions. Internally, they are coming apart. But they refuse to reveal their feelings, perhaps because of early parental messages, such as, "Don't tell the neighbors your troubles." That is a sure way to self-destruct. Performing for the sake of others destroys you. A small number may act almost psychotic, really believing that nothing has happened to them. If a person can maintain that kind of abnormal denial, then cancer is not an emotional stress, but the majority cannot. Others seem to accept the truth, yet refuse to admit it on a deeper level. These are often the ones who submit to treatment but never commit themselves wholeheartedly to trying to get well. One of my patients declined to join ECAP with the explanation, "I haven't told my children I have cancer, so how can I appear in a group? I might meet someone I know." Denial may be better than stoicism or despair, but it is not the best approach. I try to carefully convert deniers into fighters. Many cancer patients experience a flood of self-pity, an attitude of, "Why me?" This is usually linked to strong feelings of anger, only some of which are conscious. The patient wonders why he instead of someone else has been afflicted with a predisposition to cancer. Hence, many people get furious with God, as well as with the physician, the messenger who brought the bad news. Oddly enough, only a few express rage against the cigarette industry, the pesticide industry, the food additive industry, the nuclear power industry, and other external sources of malignancy. In the case of smoking, patients tend to realize that they took the risk themselves because they were unhappy. and thus get angry with family members and others who they feel made them unhappy. While the typical patient may ask, "Why me, Lord?" the exceptional patient says, as one ECAP member did, "Try me, Lord." I want to emphasize that all emotions are justified at this stage and must be expressed. Unexpressed feelings depress your immune response. Before I can help patients choose treatment, I must learn about their attitudes toward themselves and their disease. I found that we need to explore the answers to four basic questions. Number one, do you want to live to be 100? Question two, what happened to you in the year or two before your illness? Question three, what does the illness mean to you? Question four, why did you need the illness? Messages from the unconscious. The mind and body communicate constantly with each other, but most of this communication is on an unconscious level. It's necessary to get beyond the verbal conscious level to make sure that what the patient says is what he really feels. The surest way to do this is by examining images from his unconscious mind. These images surface spontaneously in dreams, which sometimes can be used to diagnose physical illness, as Carl Jung was able to do. Often, however, dream interpretation is difficult even for an experienced psychotherapist. Fortunately, there is a simpler, more reliable way to reveal unconscious beliefs. The doctor merely asks the patient to draw a picture. I give all new patients the following instructions. 1. On a white sheet of paper held vertically, draw a picture of yourself, your treatment, your disease, and your white blood cells eliminating the disease. Please have all colors of the rainbow, brown, black, and white, available to you, and use crayons. Number 2. On a separate sheet of white paper held horizontally, draw another picture or scene in color, using crayons. Number 3, you may also choose to draw an additional picture of your home and family, as well as additional images that may call forth further significant material from the unconscious. Pictures relating to conflicts or choices, such as a job or impending surgery, may also be important. Such drawings bypass verbal deceptions and get to the universal symbolic language of the unconscious. What we say is often a cover-up because we're all trained in language and use it, consciously or not, to conceal things that disturb us. But when we communicate in visual images, we tell the truth. The drawing of a young patient named Toby dramatically illustrated the predictive value of images. The young man had had regional enteritis for many years and had become addicted to painkillers. He was so depressed and angry about his condition that he prayed to God every night that he wouldn't wake up the next morning. After 2 months, he decided God probably needed more specific instructions, so he prayed for a brain tumor. In 2 months, he woke up, unable to speak, with a brain tumor. Eventually, it made him quadriplegic. The experience changed his outlook. Dying in his sleep was okay, but being unable to move or communicate wasn't. Now Toby recalled a visit to me years before. He returned, joined ECAP, and began to see the world with love and express that love to others. When Toby first came to the group, his tumor was in remission. He drew a tree whose outline looked almost exactly like the brain seen in profile. He pictured black throughout the branches. This let me know that he had a recurring disease, even though his brain scans showed none. I did not depress or frighten him by telling him so. By talking in the group about how he would deal with the recurrence, I was able to help him prepare for what I knew was coming. In this instance, the tree obviously symbolized the brain. After a long battle with his cancer, and despite quadriplegia, Toby decided to leave the hospital. At this point, when asked how he was, Toby responded, "Fine." His answer meant he was at peace and had no fear. To his doctor, it meant I was lying to him about his disease. His doctor predicted he would live 2 weeks and told his mother, "This is no TV program, it's going to be horrible." His family was able to create a warm, supportive environment, and with love, his only therapy, he improved to the point where he could move his arms again. His neurologist was courageous enough to visit him at home and afterwards said, "I see what Bernie is talking about." Toby lived 8 more months at home, a time that brought the family closer than ever and helped them share enough love to survive his death. On Memorial Day, his breathing became labored, and his mother said to him, "Toby, if you want to go, it's all right. I'll be okay. We all love you, and we'll miss you, but we'll be all right." He took three breaths and died. The holiday has become a day when he can be with his loved ones always. No matter what their content, the mere fact that a patient is willing to make the drawings shows a basic desire to survive. Some patients are unwilling to do even this much work, a clear message that they don't want to participate. They say things like, "I lost the crayons, I can't find the instructions." Others call from out of state to say they'll come to a group meeting tomorrow. I tell them, "Wait, there's some homework first, some reading and some drawings." "Fine, I'll have it done by tomorrow." It's this type of aggressive patient who has the best chance.